Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, this is Newsdesk for Thursday, February the 7th. I'm Alok Jha. The Bank of England has just cut interest rates. It's the second time in 3 months. As the results of the US elections Super Tuesday come in, we'll bring you Michael Tomasky's analysis. Scientists show that obesity in children is mostly down to nature, not nurture. A win for England against Switzerland. Is the new manager Fabio Capello's magic already shining through? Plus, our arts correspondent was at Christie's last night for this.
Fair warning to the room. At £23,500,000. All done. Sold at £23,500,000.
Find out if that broke any records. The Bank of England cut interest rates today in a bid to shore up consumer confidence and avoid sliding the UK economy into any further danger. Ashley Seeger from the Guardian's financial desk is here to discuss the implications of the move. Ashley, what does this mean for borrowers?
Well, it means in theory, if you're on a variable rate mortgage, the typical one is £100,000, it'll probably save you about £15 a month. There is, though, a question mark about how much high street banks are actually going to cut their rates by, because they're hit by the credit crunch that has prompted the rate cuts in the first place. So it isn't necessarily clear that these rate cuts will automatically be passed on by all lenders. And remember, of course, that about half the people in Britain who have mortgages have fixed rate mortgages, so they won't actually be affected by today's rate cut.
In the run-up to all of this, a lot of the economists polled said, in fact, all of them said that there was going to be a cut. I mean, it's quite unprecedented to have everyone going the same direction.
It is. Quite a few of us, though, thought that they might have cut rates last month. In fact, I think they should have cut rates last month. That's my own view. But everyone felt they would wait till this month because they were preparing their quarterly inflation report, which gives them a chance to really sort of think about where inflation and the economy are going over the next 2 years. And everyone who was looking at the same data thought, well, the economy is slowing and that will pull inflation down in the medium term, meaning a year or two. Everyone felt that a rate cut would come this month. But you're right, it is unusual that there's such unanimity in the city. That's usually a worrying sign. It usually means they're going to be wrong. But on this occasion, they weren't.
How does a cut like this affect the economy? I mean, how is it going to improve things?
A quarter point cut on its own makes very little difference to an economy of this size. But this is now the second cut we've had in the space of 3 months. In theory, it puts a little bit more money in consumers' pockets. It makes firms borrowing a bit cheaper, so it enables them to borrow a bit more to expand their business or to invest in new equipment or whatever. So you get two effects coming through on an economy, one through the consumer side, which accounts for about two-thirds of the economy, consumer spending, and the other through business financing.
And what about the housing market? Is it going to affect that?
In theory, it should improve the affordability of mortgages, although, as I said earlier, it's questionable whether it will do. On its own, I don't think a quarter point cut will make a huge difference. Having said all of that, in 2005, in August, you may recall, they made a quarter point rate cut and the housing market, which was slowing down sharply at the time, turned around and roared back up again. So in theory, it should boost the housing market, but I've got a feeling the housing market's got bigger problems with the debt overhang that it's suffering and extremely high prices. So I'm not sure it's going to boost the property market desperately.
And will rates fall any further in the coming months?
Yes, I think they will. It was interesting looking at the bank's statement they made today after their rate cut, where they said, oh yes, well, we're still very worried about inflation, and they are, that's true. But I think they're saying that because they don't want to give the impression that rates are going to be cut very sharply, because they don't want the housing market to take off again. My feeling is, though, that rates will be below 5% later in the year and possibly as low as 4.5%. That's my own view, because I take quite a gloomy view on the economy at the moment.
Ashley, thank you.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
The Guardian's daily news podcast is changing. For a start, it won't be called Newsdesk anymore. From next Monday, February the 11th, we launch Guardian Daily, which will be available to download from first thing in the morning, Monday to Friday. So you can listen to it while you're having your breakfast or take it with you on your way to work. The best news and analysis from The Guardian's top team of reporters and commentators.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis from guardian.co.uk.
A study of more than 5,000 pairs of twins has found that a child's risk of becoming overweight is mostly down to their genes rather than the environment they're brought up in. I asked one of the study's authors, Susan Carnell of University College London, for more details.
Well, basically, we did a twin study, so we were able to look at how much variation in a particular trait, in this case weights, is down to nature and nurture. And what we found was that 77% of variation was down to nature and only 23% down to nurture.
So the environment is obviously very important in whether someone's likely to be obese or not. But kind of, don't we already know that? I mean, if someone just eats a lot, aren't they just going to get fat? Do we know that already?
We do know that already on some level. So obesity is definitely a problem with energy balance. But what's interesting about our findings is we've shown that somehow obesity has been driven by our genes. So what we need to do next is find out how this is happening. And one possible way is through behaviour. And if that's true, that's great, because we can do something about the behaviour. So it's more kind of, filling in why it is that eating too much is, challenging for some people.
Because I suppose the obesity epidemic is a couple of decades old now. Our genes certainly haven't changed in that time, but it is our environment, the surroundings, the food we are eating, which has changed.
That's right. Genes haven't changed. Otherwise, heritability would have kind of gone up over the years. But the basic problem is that our genes are acting through the environment. So if we didn't have a kind of permissive environment and food wasn't around, then we would all be skinny.
So how should parents sort of try to understand and use these findings?
I think what parents need to understand is that all children will be different. And it may be that their child struggles more with kind of coping with the constant onslaught of opportunities to eat and to be sedentary. So they can certainly make changes to their home environment by, giving them access to physical activities they enjoy, things like that. And when they're older, of course, the children are going to be in the same environment as the rest of us. So they can kind of teach them good habits like walking where possible, making the healthy choice when eating out, which are going to help them cope with sort of the obesity promoting environment.
Politicians and pundits in the US are chewing over the results of this week's Super Tuesday, where 24 states cast their votes in the presidential primaries. Newsdesk's Francesca Panetta asked Guardian America editor Michael Tomasky for his analysis and began by asking who Democrat candidate Barack Obama was failing to appeal to.
Working class whites and Latinos, many of whom also, I think, are working class. So I think it's most instructive to look at what he's not getting in class terms. And it's the working class Democrat, probably not college educated. That's the constituency into which he needs to make inroads, I think, if he's going ultimately to win this.
And how can he do that?
He does need to talk a bit more about kitchen table issues and kitchen table economics in this campaign. I listened closely to her speech last night and his speech last night. Virtually every other sentence of her address had something to do with visualizing the lives led by working Americans. Some mother trying to raise her child, some displaced worker trying to find a new job or find his way through the new economy.
Give us the people in need of work. Give us the veterans.
And I guess that's the kind of language that connects to those kinds of voters. Obama's language, meanwhile, is, as people often say, somewhat more abstract.
Our time has come.
He could add a little bit more meat and potatoes to his presentation, I think.
Now, are Tuesday night's results an indication of a divided Republican Party, unsure of its directions and its principles?
To a considerable extent, yes. John McCain is obviously the winner. He's obviously going to be the nominee. But equally obviously, there's a part of the party that is saying, we're not on this train yet. And those are Southern conservatives, tend to be more religious, but they're also very economically conservative. They're not ready to pull the trigger on McCain yet. And that in turn means the elements of the party that really dislike McCain, the right-wing talk show hosts and so forth, who've been fulminating about him for the past week or so, they can carry on now.
And Senator John McCain is gaining momentum, but not all conservatives are jumping for joy.
A handful of people like Rush Limbaugh, the radio host, and Ann Coulter, the bomb-throwing whatever she is, get on their airwaves and say John McCain's no conservative and this is an outrage and I can't possibly support him, and if he's the nominee, I'm going to go vote for Hillary Clinton, which Ann Coulter said the other day.
She's more conservative than he is. I think she would be stronger on the war on terrorism.
Do they run the Republican Party? No, but they have a lot of listeners, and I think this is going to be a problem for him for a little while yet.
So how does John McCain convince core American conservatives to vote for him?
Well, see, this is where he's a little bit stuck. I would expect they will need him to say something fairly dramatic, like, I will not pursue any kind of immigration reform if I'm elected president, and I've been a little bit misguided about that in the past. But if he does too much to placate them, then he runs the risk of losing the respect of the independent moderate voters who have admired him for so long. So he's a little bit up against it.
That was Michael Tomasky. I'm Alok Jha, and this is News Desk. Still to come, a £26 million painting by Francis Bacon, and the demise of this. That great British institution. Well, if you're 25 or over. First, though, a look through today's papers. It may be Thursday, but the papers are still catching up with the Super Tuesday, or not so Super Tuesday, as the FT has it, after the failure of any candidate to land a knockout blow. The Leader column in the Times today calls the event an orgy of democracy, whilst The Guardian adds that whichever candidate claims the White House, the process is hugely beneficial for America. As we've been hearing, the Bank of England has cut interest rates by a quarter of a percentage point. The Telegraph, though, on its front page reports that greedy banks have pushed up mortgage rates in anticipation of the cut. Britney Spears appears on the front of the Mirror and the Sun. She's left hospital after being admitted last week with concerns over her mental health. The Sun reports that the singer made four emotional calls to her dad, telling him, "You've got to get me out." People on benefits raise hackles in the Mail today. State handouts are now a way of life for 6 million people, and most of them aren't even looking for a job, fumes the paper, citing a report from a committee of MPs. The Financial Times, meanwhile, has an exclusive interview with Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the jailed Russian oligarch. Formerly Russia's richest man, he tells the FT from behind bars that President Putin has undermined the rule of law and that his likely successor will be unlikely to restore it. The back pages all focus on Fabio Capello's first match in charge of England, of which more in just a second with our chief football writer. Many of the papers note the absence of Michael Owen from the new manager's lineup, and an underwhelmed Mirror report is headlined, "Boring, get used to it," neatly overlooking the fact that the team beat Switzerland 2-1.
New edition of Politics Weekly. We're joined by Labour MP Martin Salter, Catherine Bennett, writer for The Observer, and Peter Tatchell, a campaigner against injustice of all sorts. And we'll be tackling the American elections. What do we think is going to happen? Bugging and MPs. Are they a special class or are we all under surveillance? And we'll be looking at Afghanistan. Is Britain's presence working? And what's going to happen next? That's all at Politics Weekly at guardian.co.uk/politics.
As you've just heard, the new reign of England manager Fabio Capello faced its first test last night. His team beat Switzerland 2-1 in a friendly at Wembley, and The Guardian's chief football writer Kevin McCarrow was there. Kevin, how did the team perform?
It was quite good. I think the papers, including The Guardian, are all guilty of making an enormous fuss about this game because it's Capello's first match. It was a friendly, it was practice. They won. They were a bit shaky at times, but some parts of the game went well. Joe Cole was excellent on the left-hand side. Nothing revolutionary occurred, I don't think, but at least that's Capello off to a safe start.
So there were some surprise inclusions in the team. No David Beckham, of course, but a first England goal for Jermaine Genus.
He's a much improved player with Spurs this season. He seems fitter under Wandy Ramos's regime there, and better in judging when to attack. And last night he scored his first international goal. He wasn't brilliant, but to score was a breakthrough for him.
And there's no place for Michael Owen either. What does he have to do now to get back onto the team?
Well, Michael Owen has maybe scored one goal in the Premier League in the past couple of months because he's been injured earlier in the season. And I think he didn't deserve to be playing last night. It's as simple as that. And I think in some ways he's lucky to be in the squad at all. So I think the old-fashioned route applies here. Score goals for your club and then you'll be recognised by your country.
Fabio Capello has a reputation for building solid defences. How was England's defence last night?
A bit ropey. I don't think he'd be entirely pleased. In the last minute, the goalkeeper came for a cross and didn't quite gather it. Wes Brown playing at right-back isn't really a right-back, he's a centre-half. And Rio Ferdinand's at fault for one of the goals. So not happy at all, I would say.
How do you think the team are responding to Capello? I mean, is he instilling any winning sort of confidence in them?
Well, I mean, it's a kind of boot camp regime, as everyone will have read in the papers. Players being addressed for their surnames. And the players are knuckling down because they were in the doghouse having lost to Croatia and failed to qualify for Euro 2008. So now they must be seen as willing to do everything possible to help the manager. But of course, as time goes on, if results aren't good, players and their friends will start briefing against the manager and so on. So long-term happiness, as ever, depends only on winning games.
More on that at guardian.co.uk/football.
Just how much booze does it take to leave Neil Back on his surname and carried out of a post-match dinner? Is Johnny Wilkinson bonkers? Some of our guests believe so. And we also talk a little bit about the rugby too. So do join me, Ian Payne and cast, for the Six Nations show. Just go to guardian.co.uk/podcasts and there we are.
Also on Guardian Unlimited today, videos captured in Iraq show children training to kidnap and assassinate, US forces have claimed. More at guardian.co.uk/Al-Qaeda. A draft report on the future of policing, to be published later today, will recommend a drastic reduction in red tape and encourage civilian staff to take on more responsibility. Read the full report at guardian.co.uk/crime later today. And Libby Brooks argues that 10 years after the first performance of the Vagina Monologues, the V word is still abhorrent to contemporary culture. Have your say on that at guardian.co.uk/commentisfree. Fears of a recession in the arts world were again proved wrong last night. A Francis Bacon piece broke the record, selling for £26.3 million. That wasn't enough to cheer up the grumpy agent who bought it, though. He had a run-in with the photographer who'd taken his picture, demanding he delete it. Mind you, I get a bit miserable too when I buy prints from IKEA for just £26. Trying to avoid the auctioneer's eye, though, was our arts correspondent, Mark Brown.
I'm here at Christie's Auction House for tonight's post-war and contemporary art evening sale, and people are just slowly coming into the room. There's obviously lots of very rich people, lots of suits which are better than mine, lots of expensive frocks, lots of deep pockets, and what they're all gathering for is what could be a record-breaking sale. And what we're all looking at is this absolutely stupendous work by Francis Bacon, which is a triptych called Triptych 1974-77, which he actually painted when he was mourning the death through suicide of his boyfriend George Dyer. If it makes more than 26 million, it'll break the record for a work by a British or Irish artist, which was set by Bacon himself at a sale last May. There is a deal of excitement about it. Even journalists are getting involved, and there's been a sweepstake, and I've put in a pound that the painting will go for 32.5 million, so I expect to win £12 by the end of the night. Looks like the auctioneer's arrived, so I think I better start being quiet.
£23 million. Will you give me 24, sir? It's against you, and I'm selling in the doorway at £23,500,000. Fair warning to the room. At £23,500,000. All done, the paper. Sold at £23,500,000.
Well, what about that? £23.5 million. Bit of a disappointment. Everybody thought it might go for at least 26 million, which would break the record. My sweepstake guess at 32.5 million was rubbish. And so, who are the experts? There aren't any experts when it comes to art, it seems. I'm here with Pilar Ordóñez from Christie's. Now, Pilar, in some ways, a disappointing night.
I think you have to realise it's the highest ever price for a post-war and contemporary art established in Europe. I mean, we have to go back to the Bank of Sunflowers to find a price like this. I think it was an incredible result tonight.
But the estimate was 25 million and it sold for 23.5 million.
The estimate was in the region of 25 million and the work actually sold with premium for £26.3 million.
I mean, there's been some incredible sales this week with impressionist sales. How does tonight's sale compare?
Well, it's our second highest sale ever in history, so I think that shows the results speak for themselves. Thank you very much.
Christie's is emptying now. People are going out into the cold, harsh streets of St James's. Christie says it's been a very good night, and it has been in some respects because a record has been set. It's the highest price for a post-war work of art to be sold in Europe. It didn't beat the price of the bacon that was sold last year in New York, but nevertheless it is a record. And there are also records for Gerhard Richter, for Bridget Riley, for Lucia Fontana. So, yes, a good night, but maybe not quite as good as everybody was anticipating.
And we'll say ciao with something that's proving quite popular on the blogs. Grange Hill is being axed.
Well, Mr. Mitchell, all present and correct, ready to start their new lives at Grange Hill. Let's hope it's a pleasant experience for them.
No, I'm sure it will be, Mrs. Munro. One big happy family.
To those of a certain age, well, older than 25, Grange Hill stands out in kids' TV. It tackled every teenage issue from pranks to guns, makeup to drugs. There was even a hit single. The Guardian's TV writer, Gareth McLean, is here. Gareth, we're going to miss this programme, aren't we?
Well, we are, I think. But the landscape of children's television has changed in that it's not really necessary anymore. I mean, children's TV now is up to 12-year-olds, and then there's that sort of 12 to sort of 16 that's a different sort of demographic. But it was really important in its time, I think. And, you know, we've all got fond memories of it. It always crops up on those nostalgia shows, doesn't
what,
it?
What kind of issues did it try to deal with? Because it was basically trying to aim itself to teenagers who have all sorts of problems.
Oh, yeah. Well, absolutely. It tackled everything from sort of bullying to eating disorders. You know, there was, I mean, and love, teen love. Who could forget Aunt and Georgina? Do you remember them? Oh, goodness me, that was my era. When television drama works, it reflects the world back at us. I mean, I think in a way it was a sort of soap, and soap is a way that we make sense of the world. And I think that for kids growing up in sort of the sort of 70s, 80s, having that recognition of seeing your life on screen, that it wasn't just you that these things were happening to, it is really important, I think.
It just made us all feel normal. The fact that people might be bullied or they might have spots and all that kind of stuff, it just sort of showed it all in real life on telly.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that had never been done before.
What were your favourite bits?
Well, where to begin?
Where to start, yeah.
Well, I like Roland. You know, remember Big Fat Roland?
Roland.
So he always lost his contact lens on the floor. And then he just sort of found it and popped it right back in his eye again. That's before
not,
we knew the dangers of germs. No. Well, there was Imelda and Ziggy. Remember Imelda, the bully? I mean, Gripper Stebson was the sort of most famous bully, I guess, of the show. But Imelda always terrified me. And when she put fiberglass down Ziggy's back, that was a real sort of, that was a terrible thing that happened.
Well, amazing the detail you can remember.
Oh, God,
that's
well,
amazing.
Flashing back. And then there was Helen, who had a donkey in a shed. That never happened to me at school. Sure, I was bullied, but I never kept a donkey in a shed. Strange. There was Gaunch, the ginger-haired guy, and Mr. Bronson, who, you know, scary man, who actually played Hitler, I think, in one of the Indiana Jones films.
And he was in Empire Strikes Back as an Imperial general or something.
Was he? Okay, yeah, you know more about that than I do. You know, there was the guy Julian that drowned in the swimming pool. I think we've all got those sort of memories of it because it was on and it was something that everybody watched. And I guess in this sort of multi-channel age where there are, you know, so many things to watch, and that sort of communal experience, that sort of water cooler moment of children's television has passed now.
Now, we can't talk about Grange Hill without mentioning one of its most famous pupils, Zamo. And here he is in one of his finest moments.
Just say no. You don't
have to be. Gareth, tell us a bit about Zamo.
Well, I mean, that was an incredibly brave... it was his descent into heroin addiction, chasing the dragon, which we'd never heard of in Scotland, goodness me, no. And to tackle that at sort of 5:10 for kids, I mean, if you think about that now, the Daily Mail would be up in arms about that sort of thing. But they did it sort of in a sort of really grown-up way. They did it sensitively, you know, and obviously it culminated in the single, and that all went a bit cheesy, and then they met Nancy Reagan, and it was all very kind of... It sort of took on a life of its own. But I think if you look at the story and the way it was told, and it just really kind of connected with its audience. Hindsight's a funny thing, isn't it? Yeah. We can look back and scoff and go, oh my God, wasn't it terrible? It's a long time for any show to exist, and for it to have survived this long is kind of amazing. You sort of think, God, wasn't it axed years ago? You know, you look at it and I think, okay, it does work. It did. It played an important role in sort of tackling social issues, all those kind of school issues, growing up issues, and I think it shouldn't be underestimated. Just say no.
And you know what? I did say no. Today's producers for the penultimate news desk were Tim Mabey, Phil Maynard, Andy Duckworth, and in Washington, Francesca Panetta. My name's Alok Jha. Thank you for listening.
Guardian Unlimited.